Chapter 5. Goldilocks and the Trojan Horse: Creating and Maintaining Coalitions. Now, the star-belly sneetches had bellies with stars. The plain-belly sneetches had none upon thars. Those stars weren't so big. They were really so small, you might think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. But because they had stars, all the star-belly sneetches would brag, "We're the best kind of sneetch on the beaches." With their snoots in the air, they would sniff and they'd snort, "We'll have nothing to do with the plain-belly sort." Dr. Seuss. Memories of her greatness have faded, but no one did more for women's suffrage in America than Lucy Stone. In 1855, she took a stand for women's rights that moved thousands to follow in her footsteps, calling themselves Lucy Stoners in homage. Over the next century, the Lucy Stone League included aviator Amelia Earhart, poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, and artist Georgia O'Keeffe. Among today's women who qualify as Lucy Stoners are Beyoncé, Sheryl Sandberg, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Spanx founder Sarah Blakely. Lucy Stone was the first woman in America to keep her own name after getting married. It was one of her many firsts. She was the first woman from Massachusetts to earn a bachelor's degree. She was the first American to become a full-time lecturer for women's rights, OCEAN, where they inspired British philosophers John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill to publish a famous essay on the enfranchisement of women, which helped to mobilize women's suffrage activists in England. In America, perhaps the most significant effect was on a Rochester teacher named Susan B. Anthony. Stone's speech inspired her to join the suffrage movement. 2 years later, the other great suffragist of the era, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, wrote a glowing note to Anthony about Stone. "We have no woman who compares with her." For the next decade and a half, Stone, Anthony, and Stanton collaborated as the renowned leaders of the women's suffrage crusade. But long before they could realize their shared goal of equal voting rights for women, their coalition crumbled. In 1869, Anthony and Stanton severed their collaboration with Stone, splitting off to form their own women's suffrage organization. The former allies fought bitterly as was their goals, and how to overcome the barriers that prevent coalitions from succeeding. By definition, most efforts to change the status quo involve a movement by a minority group to challenge a majority. Coalitions are powerful, but they are also inherently unstable. They depend heavily on the relationships among individual members. Lucy Stone's conflict with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton shattered the most important alliance in the suffrage movement, nearly causing its demise. Through an analysis of their challenges, along with a talented entrepreneur's struggle to convince people to give her idea a chance, a hit Disney movie that almost didn't get made, and the collapse of the Occupy Wall Street movement, you'll see how building effective coalitions involves striking a delicate balance between venerable virtues and pragmatic policies. In doing so, you'll find out why singing "O Canada" can help us form alliances, why common tactics can be more influential than common values, why Western states won suffrage sooner than states in the East and the South, and why it's often wiser to partner with enemies than frenemies. The key insight is a Goldilocks theory of coalition formation. The originals who start a movement will often be its most radical members, whose ideas and ideals will prove too hot for those who follow their lead. To form alliances with opposing groups, it's best to temper the cause, cooling it as much as possible. Yet to draw allies into joining the cause itself, what's needed is a moderately tempered message that is neither too hot nor too cold, but just right. The narcissism of small differences. We assume that common goals bind groups together, but the reality is that they often drive groups apart. According to Dartmouth psychologist Judith White, a lens for understanding these fractures is the concept of horizontal hostility. Even though they share a fundamental objective, radical groups often disparage more mainstream groups as imposters and sellouts. As Sigmund Freud wrote a century ago, it is precisely the minor differences in people who are otherwise alike that form the basis of feelings of strangeness and hostility between them. White noticed horizontal hostility everywhere. When a deaf woman won the Miss America crown, instead of cheering her on as a trailblazer, deaf activists protested. Since she spoke orally rather than using sign language, she wasn't deaf enough. When a light-skinned black woman was appointed as a law professor at one university, its Black Students Association objected on the grounds that she wasn't black enough. A radical environmental activist dismissed the more mainstream Greenpeace as a mindless monster motivated by eco-buck profits and a dynamic threat to the integrity of the green movement. To explain why this kind of animosity happened, White led fascinating research on horizontal hostility in different movements and minority groups. In one study, vegans and vegetarians evaluated members of their own groups and one another's groups relative to members of the general public. Vegans showed nearly three times as much prejudice toward vegetarians as vegetarians did toward vegans. In the eyes of the more extreme vegans, the mainstream vegetarians were wannabes. If they really cared about the cause, they wouldn't eat animal products like eggs. In another study in Greece, members of the most conservative party judged the most similar party more unfavorably than they did a progressive party. And members of the most liberal party were much harsher toward the progressive party than towards even the most conservative party. Orthodox Jews evaluated conservative Jewish women more negatively than Zation the following week, in May 1869. Stone and a group of colleagues published a letter calling for a more comprehensive organization, but it was to no avail. By the fall, they had little choice but to form their own group. For more than two decades, they maintained their distance, working independently in some cases and at cross purposes in others. With the women's suffrage movement splintered, Lucy Stone needed new allies, as did Anthony and Stanton. They all found support in an unexpected place, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU, which had been formed to fight alcohol abuse, as drunken men often abused their wives and left their families in poverty. In contrast to the suffrage groups, the WCTU was heavily conservative. Its members tended to be middle and upper-class women with strong religious beliefs and traditional values. Yet somehow, coalitions between the WCTU and suffragists sprang up in almost every state in the nation. The reasons for suffragists to partner with the WCTU were clear. The suffrage movement had stalled in influencing legislation. A surge of anti-suffrage organizations was forming to work against them, and suffrage membership was dwindling. By the early 1880s, Stanton and Anthony's organization was down to just 100 members. The WCTU, meanwhile, was experiencing a membership explosion, growing from a few thousand in 1874 to 13,000 in 1876 and well over 100,000 by 1890. With the support of the country's largest women's organization, suffragists could make meaningful progress. The puzzle is why the WCTU agreed to partner with suffragists. In a clever experiment, Stanford researchers Scott Wiltermuth and Chip Heath randomly assigned people in groups of three to listen to the national anthem, O Canada, under different conditions, so this experiment would not have worked with me. But their follow-up study showed that eating disgustingly bitter chocolate was even more unpleasant when tasted simultaneously with someone else. Apparently, both positive and negative experiences are amplified when we share them, leading to even greater feelings of similarity. In seeking alliances with groups that share our values, we overlook the importance of sharing our strategic tactics. Recently, sociologists Woo-Seok Jung and Braden King of Northwestern University and Sarah Soule of Stanford University tracked the emergence of unusual alliances between social movements, like coalitions between environmental and gay rights activists, the women's movement and the peace movement, and a Marine base and a Native American tribe. They found that shared tactics were an important predictor of alliances. Even if they care about different causes, groups find affinity when they use the same methods of were more moderate in their methods, which helped the two groups find common ground. At the same time that women were organizing local WCTU clubs, Lucy Stone introduced suffrage clubs. Both groups had extensive histories with lobbying and publishing. They began to work together to lobby and speak in front of state legislatures, publish articles and distribute literature, and hold public suffrage meetings, rallies, and debates. Shared tactics only facilitate alliances up to a point. When the overlap in tactics between groups was more than 61%, coalitions became less likely. When their methods are pretty much the same, groups simply have less to learn and gain from one another. Their efforts are more likely to be redundant. Although the WCTU and suffrage groups shared a number of tactics, they also had some unique methods to teach one another. The suffragists began to march in parades and set up booths at fairs. The WCTU increasingly used petitions. Also, status differences mattered. Movements were more likely to align when one had moderately higher status than the other, as opposed to when there was no status difference or an extreme status difference. It's obvious that a lower status movement would pursue the visibility associated with a higher status partner. But there are benefits to the higher status group, too. Sociologists Jung, King, and Soule explain, as challengers to the established social order, movements need to refresh and update their agenda continuously in order to be seen as cutting edge, authentic, and relevant. If they fail to innovate their movement agenda and engage with new ideas, a movement can become obsolete and lose touch with its original constituency. For this reason, high status movements may seek to absorb newly emerging or previously ignored vintage issues. Together, suffragists and temperance activists persuaded several states to allow women to vote. Waves were too inefficient, and X-rays were too dangerous. Then she came across a device that could convert physical vibration into energy. If you put it under a train, for example, you could collect the energy the train generated. Although it wasn't practical to have people gathering near trains to capture their energy, she realized that sound travels through the air by vibration. What if she could use ultrasound, which is invisible and silent, to generate air vibrations and convert them into wireless power? Her physics professors said it was impossible. Ultrasonic engineers agreed it couldn't be done. Some of the world's most respected scientists told her she was wasting her time on the effort. But then she won an invention competition, and a journalist challenged her to demo the technology at a digital conference just 4 weeks later. With a proof of concept, but no working prototype, she had a chicken and egg problem. She needed funding to build a prototype, but her idea was so radical that investors wanted to see a prototype first. As the solo founder of a technology startup with no engineering background, she needed allies to move forward. 3 years later, I met Perry at a Google event. After landing $750,000 in seed money from Mark Cuban, Marissa Meyer, and Peter Thiel's Founders Fund, her team had just finished its first functional prototype. It could power devices faster than a wire, at longer distances, and would be ready for consumers in 2 years. By the end of 2014, her company, Ubeam, had accumulated 18 patents and $10 million in venture funding. Perry took her place on stage in a lineup that included Snoop Dogg, a Nobel Prize winner, and former President Bill Clinton. She was the only one to get a standing ovation. Debate continued about how well the prop to inspire people, we should start with why. If we communicate the vision behind our ideas, the purpose guiding our products, people will flock to us. This is excellent advice, unless you're doing something original that challenges the status quo. When people championing moral change explain their why, it runs the risk of clashing with deep-seated convictions. When creative nonconformists explain their why, it may violate common notions of what's possible. Researchers Deborah Meyerson and Maureen Scully have found that to succeed, originals must often become tempered radicals. They believe in values that depart from traditions and ideas that go against the grain, yet they learn to tone down their radicalism by presenting their beliefs and ideas in ways that are less shocking and more appealing to mainstream audiences. Meredith Perry is a tempered radical. She made an implausible idea plausible by obscuring its most door technique, where you lead with a small request to secure an initial commitment before revealing the larger one. By opening with a moderate ask instead of a radical one, Steinman gained allies. Coalitions often fall apart when people refuse to moderate their radicalism. That was one of the major failures of the Occupy Wall Street movement, a protest against economic and social inequality that began in 2011. That year, polls showed that the majority of Americans supported the movement, but it soon fell apart. Activist Serja Popovich marvels that its extreme positioning alienated most of its potential allies. Its fatal error, he argues, was naming the movement after the radical tactic of camping out, which few people find attractive. He believes that had the group simply relabeled itself the 99%, it might still exist. The Occupy name implied that the only way you could belong was if you dropped everything you were doing, positive and wholly negative relationships. We can have connections that are both positive and negative. Psychologists call them ambivalent relationships. You might know them as frenemies, people who sometimes support you and sometimes undermine you. Stone's relationships with both Stanton and Anthony were deeply ambivalent. They had been both allies and adversaries. On the one hand, she admired Stanton's wit and Anthony's industriousness, and they had a proven record of productive collaboration. On the other hand, Stone objected to their lunatic friends and wild alliances, which threatened the respectability of the women's suffrage movement. And Anthony and Stanton had a pattern of duplicity. They signed Stone's name to an ad complimenting their racist benefactor without her permission. More recently, Stone had written to Stanton in the fall of 1869 proposing the hearty, active cooperation of all the friends of the cause, better than either could do alone, and assuring her that Stone's organization shall never be an enemy or antagonist of yours. Yet at the convention launching Stone's group, Anthony attempted an ill-fated coup to elect Stanton as president. Stone invited her to the podium, and Anthony concluded by accusing Stone of attempting to nullify and crush out her organization. In 1872, Stanton reached out to Stone with a proposal for reconciliation, urging her to let bygones be bygones, let all personalities be buried in the work that is before us. Stone took some conciliatory steps, sharing Stanton's articles and speeches in her newspaper. Then came a letter from Anthony proposing to cooperate and make a systematic campaign, inviting Stone to Rochester to settle the question that we are all together as one grand woman. Stone declined. With the benefit of hindsight, it's easy to judge Stone's refusal as a stubborn mistake. Had she accepted, the organizations might have won the right to vote years earlier. But if you examine how ambivalent relationships affect our stress levels, you will find some wisdom in Stone's resistance. To discover the most effective way to handle ambivalent relationships, Michelle Duffy, a management professor at the University of Minnesota, led a study surveying police officers on how often they were undermined and supported by their closest coworker, as well as their levels of stress and absence from work. Not surprisingly, negative relationships were stressful. When officers felt undermined by their closest coworker, they were less committed, took more unauthorized breaks, and were absent from work more often. What happened when the undermining colleague was also supportive at times? Things didn't get better, they got worse. Being undermined and supported by the same person meant even lower commitment and more work missed. The good news, with your arch enemy, unless you were attempting to spike his gin with hemlock. Instead of avoiding her enemies, Lucy Stone sought them out and actively engaged with them. She helped convert Julia Ward Howe, a prominent poet who wrote The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Howe had been invited to attend a suffrage meeting and came only reluctantly, with a rebellious heart, regarding Stone as one of her dislikes. But after listening to Stone's speech, Howe became a close ally and one of the great leaders of the movement. In 1855, a heckler disrupted a convention by describing suffragists as unfit for marriage, disparaging the movement as a few disappointed women. Instead of ignoring him, Lucy Stone addressed him directly in her speech, and the audience roared with applause. The last speaker alluded to this movement as being that of a few disappointed women. From the first years to which my memory stretches, I have been a disappointed college student named Frances Willard wrote in her journal that Lucy Stone was in town and noted, "I don't like her views." Given her own conservative opinions, Willard joined the temperance movement, but years later became one of the most influential suffrage leaders. She reflected that Stone was a force behind her change of heart. "I remember when I was dreadfully afraid of Susan, and of Lucy, too. But now I love and honor these women, and I cannot put into words my sense of what it means to have the blessings of these women who have made it possible for more timid ones like myself to come along and take our places in the world's work. If they had not blazed the trees and pioneered the way, we should not have dared to come." In 1876, Willard led the effort to align suffragists with temperance workers. Research would later show that over the next two decades, every time Willard visited a state, the odds of a suffrage-temperance alliance spiked. How did she convince the conservative WCTU members to partner with the liberal suffragists? A clue to her success can be found in Hollywood, where movies live and die based on how well writers can persuade executives to buy into their visions. Familiar makes the heart grow fonder. In the early 1990s, a group of screenwriters proposed something that had never been done at Disney. They wanted to make an animated movie based on an original concept. Departing from a half-century of hits with time-honored tales like Cinderella and Snow White, they set out to write a fresh story from scratch. Studio chief Jeffrey Katzenberg was skeptical, telling colleagues it was an experiment. "No one had any confidence in it," director Rob Minkoff recalls. "It was seen as the B-movie at Disney." The script eventually became The Lion King, which was the highest-grossing film of 1994, winning two Oscars and a Golden Globe. Katzenberg had said he would get down on his knees in appreciation if it brought in $50 million. By 2014, it had earned over $1 billion. Like many original ideas, the movie almost never got off the ground. It was conceived as Bambi in Africa with lions instead of deer as the protagonists. But after the first script failed, five of the writers gathered to rethink it. They sat together for 2 days, batting around ideas and weaving an epic tale about the succession of kings, and then pitched the story to a group of Disney executives. The first to respond was CEO Michael Eisner, who wasn't getting it. Grasping for a hook, he asked, "Could you make this into King Lear?" Coincidentally, Minkoff had reread that Shakespeare play a few weeks earlier, and he explained why the concept didn't fit. Then, from the back of the room, a producer named Maureen Donnelly raised another Shakespearean suggestion. "No, this is Hamlet." Suddenly, entered the radical one, as it violated traditional gender role stereotypes by proposing that women and men were equals in all domains. The societal reform argument was more moderate, as it affirmed gender role stereotypes in suggesting that the unique qualities conservatives already valued in private life could also contribute to public life. In a form of public motherhood, enfranchised women could benefit society by promoting education, limiting government corruption, and helping the poor. When McCammon and colleagues coded suffrage speeches, newspaper columns, banners, and leaflets that were produced over the course of a quarter century, the justice argument appeared earliest and most frequently. Overall, suffragists wielded the justice case 30% of the time, compared with barely more than half that often for the societal reform argument. But justice arguments fell on deaf ears with the WCTU members, who clung to traditional gender roles and rejected the notion that women were the equals of men. The societal reform argument also failed to resonate with familiar values. Conservative temperance workers were aiming for stability, not change. It was Francis Willard, now an emerging WCTU leader, who ingeniously reframed the pitch and made it widely acceptable. How the West was won. Francis Willard didn't use the justice argument or the societal reform argument. She didn't even present the issue as a suffrage ballot. Instead, she called it a home protection ballot. Willard saw suffrage as a weapon of protection from the tyranny of drink. Likening the ballot to a powerful sunglass, she promised to use it to burn and blaze on the saloon till it shrivels up and in lurid vapors curls away like mist. Protecting the home was a familiar goal. Odds of joining forces with the WCTU in that state increased significantly, as did the odds that a state would eventually pass suffrage. Willard's home protection argument consistently moved the needle, but just how far depended on timing. She had the biggest impact when the WCTU was under threat. When she visited states after prohibition legislation failed, or saloons became more widespread, WCTU coalitions with suffragists were the most likely. The conservative WCTU members felt that their mission was at risk and began to see suffrage as a valuable weapon in their war against alcohol abuse. Willard helped WCTU members make sense of their political defeats by interpreting them to be the results of political weakness, McCammon and a colleague explain. By convincing WCTU members that women's voting rights could help win prohibition laws, Willard aligned WCTU thinking with that of the suffragists' partners. Originals occasionally need to reframe their ideas to appeal to their audience. Willard smuggled the vote inside the Trojan horse of fighting alcohol abuse. But that argument didn't work with every group she addressed. The justice argument attracted the most radical women to the cause, as they favored equal gender roles. With the highly conservative temperance activists, the most tempered argument for home protection cemented coalitions. But for converting other allies to actually join the suffrage movement, the home protection argument was too tempered. McCammon's research shows that to convert more women to believe in suffrage as an end, not simply as a means to other ends, a Goldilocks pitch was necessary: the moderate societal reform argument. For movement leaders to succeed in organizing potential recruits, they must strike the appropriate balance between resonating with the existing cultural rep in either association. Hence, they may as well combine, for they have only one mind and one purpose. Although Anthony and Stanton never mended fences with Stone, when Stone passed away, the sheer force of her contributions compelled them to speak glowingly of her. "There is none more winning than Lucy Stone," Anthony declared. "We have never had a woman in our whole 50 years of this movement who could go before an audience and melt the heart of everyone in it like that woman. She stood alone. In Stanton's eyes, the death of no woman in America had ever called out so general a tribute of public respect and esteem. Stone was the first who really stirred the nation's heart on the subject of women's wrongs, and their disagreement many years earlier was because Stone felt the slaves' wrongs more deeply than her own. My philosophy was more egotistical. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, philosopher George Santayana wrote. That would prove to hold true for the American women's suffrage movement on at least two occasions. In 1890, two members of Anthony's organization, furious at her scheming to create a national organization and the move toward tempered radicalism, split off to form a rival group that attacked the efforts to unify. Anthony and Stanton quashed it, but they were not around to warn their successors against the narcissism of small differences. At the turn of the 20th century, in the twilight of their lives, they handed the leadership of the National Suffrage Organization on to Carrie Chapman Catt, then a temperance activist and WCTU member. But a more radical woman named Alice Paul, not content to pursue suffrage with tempered tactics like lecturing, writing, and lobbying, favored bolder actions. She embarked on a hunger strike and rejected Catt's nonpartisan position, blaming the Democratic Party for the failure to grant suffrage. Paul set up. The organizational model Stone provided would be adopted by Carrie Chapman Catt in the final successful march to an amendment in 1920.